Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. Recall your childhood, and one of the things you may remember is drawing, the excitement that came with a box of crayons, a set of markers or pencils, and a stack of paper. Now, why do some of us keep drawing while most of us stop? Naturalist and writer Peter Steinhardt joins us today to talk about why we draw. Our guest is the author of The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. At the outset of the book, Steinhardt notes that since the middle of the 20th century, abstraction and expressionism have been the lodestones of fine art, and drawing has been diminished and disparaged. Commercial design and illustration these days is largely done on computers. He also notes that at many art schools across the country, students may go through a four-year program without taking drawing or painting courses. But Steinhardt sees signs of a renaissance of figure drawing by amateurs, people like you and me. Why is this happening? What is it that drawing gives us? Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number to dial is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, dial us toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Peter Steinhardt. For 12 years, he was an editor and columnist at Audubon. His articles have appeared in many publications, including Harper's and the New York Times. He has twice been a finalist for a National Magazine Award. He's the author of five books now, including The Company of Wolves. His latest book, The Undressed Art, Why We Draw, is published by Knopf. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Peter Steinhardt, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You say if there's a renaissance of drawing taking place, it's not driven by the art market, but by something inside artists themselves. I mentioned you think that this is a movement of amateurs. Why are people returning to drawing?
Well, I think it's a matter of experiencing things for yourself. In our day and age, I think we find this harder and harder to do. And an artist is like a naturalist, is somebody who's looking at life around them, asking what things are and what they are and why they, how they connect. It's a way of engaging deeply and personally with the world and of looking long and hard at things and figuring out what you think and feel about them. And it's a sort of a way of confronting the strangeness of the world and making it comfortable and familiar. And even of getting your heart and mind doing the same thing at the same time. And I think modern life makes this kind of engagement increasingly difficult. Most of the world is privately owned and turned to commercial purposes, and most of the information we need is given to us only after it's been mediated by some other party, and often that's given to us in terms of somebody else's political or commercial or psychological interests. It's harder and harder to see things for yourself. So if there's a renaissance of drawing going on now, it's because we want to find our own originality.
Yeah. Now, people who return to drawing, is it difficult to reach the speed that's required, and that speed is slow, in order to see a subject and try to capture its essence on paper?
Well, it's something that requires a lot of application. You know, I think that when you relearn to draw as an adult, as opposed to the kinds of things you were doing when you were a child. In a way, you're reprogramming your brain. You're building new neural connections all the time that you're doing it. And drawing is requires a lot of very different individual skills and different individual activities going on in very precise sequences in the brain. You have to see a particular line segment. You have to remember it long enough to transpose it to some other part of the brain, which is translating that into a line, and then some other part of the brain, which is instructing the fine motor muscles and things like that, to put it on the page, and then to some other part of the brain, which is judging whether it's in the right place and so on. There are an awful lot of very finite little things going on in the brain in very precise sequence, and they involve disparate parts of the brain. And so essentially what you're doing is reprogramming yourself to be able to do this. Some people learn it very, very quickly. Other people take more time, but I have the sense that pretty much anybody can learn to do it within a certain degree of facility.
Hmm. When artists talk about drawing, what kinds of things do they have to say about the act of drawing?
I think all kinds of things. Every artist is an individual, and every artist approaches it, I think, in a slightly different way. One of the lovely things about drawing groups is that that you can be in a room with sometimes 30. I was in a group last night with 60 people in the room, and if you walk around the room, you've got a different take from every single drawer on the same subject. And so you'll find in a drawing group, you'll find people who are given to abstraction. They tend to stand farther away and draw forms. And you find people who are given to representation who stand closer and try to get fine detail and so on. And so they're all over the map as to what they say and what they want to get out of the drawings and the approaches that they take.
Yeah. Yesterday afternoon, ahead of heading home to read the book, I spoke a little bit with an art and architecture student who works part-time here at the radio station, and he thought this was a wonderful idea, your book on the undressed art, and I think he's looking forward to reading it after I hand it off to him. But we got into a very quick conversation about drawing, and he said a couple of things that I thought were very interesting. He said you begin to see things you hadn't noticed, and he said the world has changed.
I think that's very much true. You know, my own experience with this, I think, you tend to draw things that you're really interested in. As you gain facility, you tend to notice things that you can apply this skill to in new ways. And one of the things that was a surprise to me, I think, when I came back to drawing in later in life, is I had been very, very interested in landscape, and I thought that's what I wanted to draw. And as I worked and worked at it, I found that I was drawing people more and more and more and more and more. And today I'm really preoccupied with the human face and its expressiveness and its individuality. And I find myself staring at people a great deal more than I used to. I'm sure it's unnerving to people, but it's something that occupies a lot of my thinking time now.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people who draw, they concentrate a lot of their attention on the human form and the face.
And this is, of course, natural because we're really a people-watching device. The brain is a people-watching organ, if you really look at it. Huge amounts of the brain are devoted simply to visual contact with the human gesture or with the human face. We have clusters of cells in the brain that activate only on when you look at a sort of a particular view of a human. There are clusters that respond only to a view of a hand grasping an object, and others that only respond to a view, say, of a hand coming toward you, and others that respond only to a person staring at you. There's a large part of the brain is simply devoted to monitoring what goes on with other people, and that's natural. We're a highly social creature, and we spend a lot of time trying to judge what intentions of other people are and what the feelings of other people are. And we're a remarkably expressive species as well. We have, just thinking of the human face, we have 43 facial muscles, which is more than any other animal has, and we're remarkably expressive with it. Our faces are capable of something like 10,000 different expressions, and we can spend a lifetime learning to read the expressions. They're very, very subtle and grayed into one another and so on. So we're essentially being very human when we get preoccupied with the human form and with human gesture and with human facial expressions.
Yeah. Well, the face then is very difficult to draw because of all the possibility that is contained there.
Not only that, but since we're all people-watching organisms, we judge each other's artwork and each other's proficiency most acutely when it comes to the human face and figure. I can draw a tree, and you can look at it and say, well, it's nice, but you'll have no idea whether it's like the tree that I was drawing. But if I draw a picture of a human form or human body or a human face, you'll note immediately the errors in it. If the eyes are too close, or the mouth is wrong, or the shading is wrong, you'll catch it right away. So drawing the human figure and face is the best test of one's skill as an artist as well.
Yeah. Van Gogh, you tell readers in The Undressed Art, wanted most to paint faces and eyes.
He said, we remember him for his wheat fields,
right,
and cypress trees and so on, but in his journals and letters, he's constantly talking about his desire to become a painter, a recorder of the human drama, especially of peasant life. And in fact, once one of the times that he was about to commit himself to an asylum, he was choosing the asylum based on the fact that they had, the inmates there worked in the fields where he would get models to draw, and it was very difficult for him to find anybody who would pose for him.
Mm-hmm. This brings me to ask you about the difference between drawing and painting. They're similar but different. You know, if you visit a beautiful natural place, you may find an artist sitting at an easel painting. Is the difference color, or are there other differences?
No, I think the difference is not color, because you find people drawing with pastels, which is a color medium. You find people essentially drawing with wash in, colored washes as well, colored pencils, or even applying watercolor to it. I think the difference is really in the kind of intellectual activity that goes into it. A drawing, by my definition, is not, and this does coincide with the medium that, the media that people tend to use, but a drawing is really an act of discovery, of one's own feelings or of the nature of the world. And it's not expected to be complete or to be the definitive word on any subject. It's something personal and provisional. Painting, on the other hand, is likely to translate that discovery into something broader and more calculated. And so drawing is, in the title of the book, an undressed art, in that it is spontaneous, personal, undisguised. It's unaffected by the fashions of the marketplace. So you can have color in a drawing. You can have essentially a painting is an amalgamation of many discoveries that you have made and as you looked to draw, and it is the result of a lot of calculated decision as to what goes where and what you leave out and what you put in, and how all of these different observations fit into a unified whole. It's a far more difficult thing to do to paint.
Yeah. So, a drawing, would it be accurate or fair to say a drawing is more a sketch, an impression?
Yeah, it certainly can be that. Although an impression can be, does not necessarily have to be quick. There are schools that teach old master style drawings where a student is expected to spend 60 hours on a single drawing to get it right. And to look very penetratingly at it, to perfect his skill. Where, on the other hand, you can have something like a doodle, which can convey just as much.
Matisse said, "To draw is to make an idea precise. Drawing is the precision of thought. Writing is also a way to make an idea precise. And you're a writer. What have you learned about drawing by writing about drawing?
I'm not sure. I've learned a lot about writing from drawing. What I do understand, I have increasingly understood that we have different kinds of intelligence within it. Drawing is something that comes out of our evolved capacities for thinking, and humans have several systems in their brains for coding and memorizing things. That's for taking complex meanings into mind and then holding them there and subjecting them to other brain functions. When we're born, much of the information we take in is kinesthetic. That is, it's the warmth, the temperature, or the texture of things, because touch is extremely important to us at that time. As we get older, visual systems become extremely important. They're there at birth. A child recognizes his or her mother's face within hours of birth and responds only to that in certain kinds of ways. As we grow older, we develop a verbal system for thinking as well. And we're all much more aware of how language is important to us and how we hold meanings in mind by using words. But we also do this visually by making images. And after all, we all dream, and we all hold visual images in memory. And, drawing is a way of just extending and manipulating those images that we hold in our minds.
What was it that led you to delve into what is happening in the process of drawing? What led you to write The Undressed Art?
Well, I drew as a child, and when I entered adolescence, I began to draw cartoons, and through college, I drew for a college humor magazine, and I began to come back to more serious drawing in my early 20s. But as soon as I got a job and had children, I found that I was doing that full time, and I drifted away from it for years. At some point, I woke up one morning and said, "You know, I'm spending all my time writing and raising kids, and I'd like another part of my life to open up." So I started drawing much more seriously. And as I joined a drawing group, and I started finding other drawing groups, and I realized that there were an awful lot of people doing this. I eventually, while I was working on this book, I found more than 85 groups in the San Francisco Bay Area that I could just drop in on. It's possible in this area to go drawing every day at a different group, and not have to repeat a group for a month even. And that suggests there's a large number of people out there. And as I looked at people's drawings and looked at mine, I realized that most of what we do, we throw away. Most of this is kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. Good drawings are kind of a surprise and supernaturally rare. And I wonder, well, why are we doing this? What are we what are we spending our time at? Right. What is the what's keeping us at it? So I just set that as the task before me, to figure out why this fascination, why does this become a kind of obsession with us all? You find people in their 90s who've been doing it all their lives, and a day without drawing to them is a day without air.
Yeah. One of the people that you write about in the book, briefly, you tell us about a woman by the name of Kate Bennett. She's a pianist, 61 years old, recently taken up drawing. Mm-hmm. And she told you she took up drawing because she wanted to see. She said, "I'm seeing it, but I'm not translating it into anything meaningful, into anything that has to do with my life."
Mm-hmm.
A desire, but yet some frustration.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it helps to see drawing as a, not as an expressive activity, as we have been led to believe it is, but as a conceptual activity that we draw to see, we draw to understand, we draw to put something in mind in an original way, and to comprehend it in an original way, and I think that's one of the big things that drives us all to draw. At some point, I mean, it always is expressive. In the end, it's the drawing that you get is an expression of the way you have interpreted the world around you, and that's quite rewarding. But the act of comprehending is the big payoff for us all, I think, and the engagement that we have with an object or with other people as a result of this activity.
Yeah. The groups that you can go to there in the San Francisco Bay Area, you report that they're all different. Each group has its own personality. How do groups differ, and what's the value of going to more than one group?
Well, there are some groups that are extremely serious and quiet, and there are some groups that are very relaxed and very informal and kind of raucous and so on. I don't know, you know, it's sort of a roll of the dice as those groups get put together, the personalities that put them together, that probably determines how these come out. What I found really wonderful about drawing with other groups is that you see more views of the world. You meet more people who can talk about this with you. You have the sense of an ever-widening community and of the enormous variety of qualities of mind that go into drawing. You learn a lot from other people. Certainly writers are notorious for borrowing from other writers, but artists do as well. You just don't notice it as much because that visual display that you get strikes you as so much different in each person, I think.
Hmm. What are drawing sessions like?
There's a lot in common with them. There tend to be long pose groups and short pose groups. A long pose group, you know, will meet for 2 or 3 hours, and a model will assume a pose and keep it for the entire 2 or 3 hours, working in 20-minute segments with usually a 5-minute break between each segment, going back to that same pose. In short pose groups, there's a little bit more variety. There are groups that are more oriented toward animation and those kinds of things, where you may have the model changing pose every 30 seconds or every minute or every 2 minutes. I imagine it's really exhilarating work for a model to do that, because essentially a model comes up with 150 to 200 poses in an evening or an afternoon. And the artists are really working fast. I think the stock group will start out with quick gestures, which are usually 2-minute poses, maybe 5 or 10 of them, and then maybe move to some 5 minutes, and then and maybe a few 10 minutes, and then work on through the evening with 20-minute poses. And those can be held in people's homes or in drawing studios at colleges or in community art centers. They can be, you find sometimes they're crammed into very small living rooms. Sometimes they're in big open studios with a lot of lighting. And there are some in which there are so many people in attendance that the models are on stands in the middle of the room and people surrounding them. There's a lot of variety in that sense. The kinds of groups I'm describing tend to be drop-in rather than private sessions. So there are a lot of private groups that you don't get invited to. But in the drop-in sessions, you usually pay a model's fee of $5 to $10 for the session.
Hmm.
They are immensely quiet while people are drawing, and then during the breaks, there's a sort of hum of conversation. Some of them have music on when you're drawing. Some of them don't.
What can you tell us about the communication that goes on between model and artist?
It varies, and of course, one of the things that you find after you start doing this is that your concept of what a model is like will change very quickly. Modeling is very hard work. It's hard on the body. It requires a certain kind of personality to do it. And when you find a good model, you're just thrilled. And what a good model is somebody who is there, who is very present all the time, who's kind of communicating with you all the time. There's a stock college newspaper article that I've seen at least a dozen examples of where it's some senior has needed a couple extra bucks, so he signed himself up with the art department to model nude for a drawing class. And the article is about how he took off his clothes and survived this ordeal of nudity and put on his clothes and went home. And what I sense is probably during this session, that the artists were probably getting nothing from him at all. Either he was very self-conscious or he was very rapt and withdrawn, and they probably didn't draw very well with him. When you've got a professional model, mm-hmm. someone who's worked with us for a while and who's comfortable with their body and is aware of what the job calls for, there is a kind of compassion that goes between a model and an artist. That is, the artist comes into the room ready to receive what a model is going to give, and a model comes into the room with something to give, and it's a very nonverbal thing. It's not at all a sexual thing. It's an expression of character or of emotion or something. It can be extremely subtle, or it can be sometimes a model will. Male model will come with props, a big sword or a tennis racket or something like that, and so you sort of recognize the gestures there. Sometimes things are much more internal and psychological.
Hmm. You write in The Undressed Art that when it comes to drawing a nude from a model, there is a moment or two of appraisal, though. There's a quick flash of that. Stuff we all have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is one of the fun things in the experience, and you see this as I've been doing this long enough that I'm sometimes even not aware of it. But at the start of a session, the model usually comes in a robe, and at the start of the session, the model just drops the robe. And there's usually this moment of appraisal that goes on around the room. And if you watch the eyes of the artists, particularly in large groups, particularly in groups where you see people who haven't done this in a long time, it's really clear that you're seeing these flickers of desire and shame go about the room. And the models that I've talked to about this say, yeah, they're quite used to this, that there's this moment of appraisal, and one of the models says, they're going, I can see them behind those eyes, they're just going, nice, not so nice. And they're appraising the model in terms of contemporary standards of beauty and sexuality and so on. But that dies just instantly. Mm-hmm. It lasts only a few seconds, and then as soon as you start to draw, you're doing something else. And I have artists that I talk to who over and over again I get the same answer. I just can't lust and draw at the same time. And there's an example in the book also of an artist friend who took his drawing pad and materials into one of those North Beach strip joints where they have private rooms, and he was trying to draw a stripper from one of them, but what he found was that every 30 seconds or 2 minutes or so, as he was getting into the drawing, this little window would flap shut and he'd be having to feed quarters into it to keep it open all night. And he came home with just these really embarrassing scrawls of a dancer that meant nothing at all to him. And he never went back.
Back to the idea of the model as part of the equation, that you need something from the model, that he or she has to be with you there, and there has to be there has to be a kind of generosity.
I think absolutely. There has to be a great amount of generosity on the part of the model, and there has to be something like that, or at least something corresponding to that, an openness, a willingness to listen, a kind of compassion on behalf of the artist, too. So it becomes a very social act, and it's one of the great attractions in it. I think it's one of the things that keeps us coming back, is that we establish these kinds of relationships, they're kinds of friendships that we establish in the course of a short time drawing, that relates us to one another in a lovely way.
Hmm. Are some of the models that you've gotten to know over time, do they draw?
Only a few of them, and I'm sort of at a loss as to why that is. I think it may be also that it may have to do with the fact that artists in general are fairly introverted people. And I think one of the things that brings them to this is that they have a chance to engage in this dialogue without sort of sticking their necks out too far. And I think a great many of the models, certainly in the Bay Area, certainly in the New York area, are people who are dancers and actors and actresses who are interested in how expressive they can become with using their bodies. And so I think they're coming at it from a slightly different angle in general. Although, you know, that kind of generalization is not really a good one, because you find artists who can be very, very expressive and in other ways than visually, and you also find models who do draw.
Naturalist and writer Peter Steinhardt is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's with us today talking about why we draw. He is the author of The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Do you draw? Why? Are you a member of a drawing group in the area? Are there drawing groups in the area? Give us a telephone call. Join the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. A little while back, we talked about children and how most, if not all of us, draw when we're children. In the book, The Undressed Art, you note that when children begin to draw, they draw symbols, not likenesses.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
It's really an interesting thing, that the way childhood drawing unfolds identically in all of us. The same things happen at the same age. It's kind of like watching insect metamorphose, and this happens in all cultures, too, that has been studied. At two, a child begins to scribble. At 2.5 to 3, a child can draw a circle, and then dots or smaller circles appear inside that larger circle, and rays sprout out the circumference like the rays of a sunburst. And at 3 or 4, these little circles and dots inside the circle diminish to 2 for eyes and 1 for a nose and 1 for a mouth. And the rays diminish to 4, 2 for arms and 2 for legs. And the very first pictorial drawing a child does is almost always a human face. And most childhood drawing grows out of this pattern. A house tends to evolve out of a face with a square and a triangle, and then eyes for windows and a mouth for a door. Then as a child grows older and is trying to interpret more of the world, they try to make the human depictions individual. So first thing they want to do is mom and dad, so they may add a ball cap for dad or a handbag for mom or something like that. But what they're doing is they're adding symbols to the drawings. And in fact, the reason the child is doing this is that the child cannot see in the more complicated way that is required for the sort of drawing that we have been talking about through the rest of this interview. A six-year-old usually can't draw a diamond because he can't make the lines the same length and the angles the same angles. And in fact, if you watch a child draw, you put an object before them and you'll see that the head goes down and it doesn't go up. He doesn't really look at the object. He's drawing something inside the head. If you present them with a teacup with a handle turned away from them, they'll draw the teacup in profile with the handle on the side. This has long been known. In 1895, a British psychologist, James Sully, who was studying this, studying childhood drawings, and he simply asked a child to tell him what he was doing, and the child said, "First I think, and then I draw my think."
Oh.
And the kind of drawing that we want, what happens with the children is that as they try to get more facile at this, as they try to see the individuality and the uniqueness of things and render those in drawings, their skills don't really keep up with it at that level. And what's happening is that by about 9 or 10, their language skills have gotten much, much more in advance of their visual skills, and they can do more with language, and the inability to keep it up visually is frustrating. And that really is what gets them to quit. Most of us, I think 9 out of 10 of us apparently, stop drawing at about that age, and about 1 in 10 of us continue to draw through it.
Yeah. Some time ago, I spoke with a writer on this program by the name of David Sachs, and he wrote a book about the alphabet titled Language Visible, Unraveling the Mystery of the Alphabet from A to Z. And at some point in our past, you know, we wrote down, people, you know, wrote the alphabet. I mean, the alphabet was a way of depicting something. I mean, in a sense, it is drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any connection, distant or not distant, between written language and drawing?
Well, I think we've probably lost, we've been writing so long, lost the pictorial connections. Although, go out and take a course in Chinese and you'll see it.
Right.
See it come up again, because there you write with a brush, and the brushes still have the pictures with them. The word ma for horse is really a picture of a horse, and so on. Where one interesting connection I think I do see is that people's handwriting is so individual,
yeah,
that we take it as proof of their existence, the way, you know, their individual existence, the way we accept fingerprints as individuality, and drawing is very much the same thing. You're putting your own perception, your own brain organization, your own brain quality into both of the things in an interesting way. And one's drawing is as unique as one's handwriting, and I think there's some connection there.
People who study the human brain, have they thought about the question, why do people draw?
I don't, you know, I didn't find a lot of discussion of this. We would couch that within evolutionary studies, and a lot of evolutionary scientists have simply dismissed artwork as evolutionary meaningless. And oddly, I think the first person that I came into contact with who had looked at this question of why we draw in that sense was a physicist, rather than an evolutionary scientist. And I'm not really sure why that is so, but I think it may have to do with the fact that we still are just beginning to understand how the brain is organized and how it. You know, we don't really even have a clear definition, I think, or a clearly accepted definition of what consciousness is yet. And I would say that as time goes on, we're going to see a lot more interest in this, a lot more interest in the creative aspects of consciousness and so on. We've seen a lot of interest in it, but we still can't measure what's going on in the brain very well. We can't, we can do MRI scans, which will tell us kind of roughly what part of the brain is lighting up at what time. But we don't really see it on a neuron to neuron kind of basis is very invasive and very painstaking. And I think those kinds of efforts will probably be reserved for things we consider pathological first.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if there's something to do here with the fact that most of us stop drawing, and so then we don't see it any longer as something that particularly interests us or is worthy of study.
Well, it certainly takes back seat to language. And of course, this is ours is a culture which rewards linguistic skills and analytical skills far above all other things. I'm very taken with Howard Gardner's studies at Harvard about the different learning styles that children have, and he's identified a dozen different styles of learning, which essentially means different styles of memorizing and coding things. And I think what this says is that the human brain is immensely varied from individual to individual, and that we all have a variety of skills and styles of learning and coding and expressing things. Some of us are kinesthetic, that is, we're athletic about it. Some of us are visual, that is, we're visual artists. Some of us are musical, and some of us are verbal and analytical. And some of us have great insight into other people outside of us. Some of us have great insight into ourselves. And each of us has a blend of these kinds of approaches to life. Some of us are good at some of them, and some of us are no good at some of them. You meet people who have absolutely no empathy. And how in nature could they have survived, you wonder. But that's part of the human genome, part of the makeup.
Yeah. The physicist that you mentioned a moment or two ago, Eric Harth, very interesting. He says that, you know, think about art and drawing is immensely useful in terms of thinking about our evolution.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it is, you know, one of the things that we do that that non-human animals do not do.
Yeah, I mean, drawing is something, it's as distinctly human as bipedal locomotion is. It's something very, very unique to the species. We've seen hucksters and showmen put brushes into the trunks of elephants or the hands of chimpanzees, but then claim that they are painting, but essentially they're manipulating materials. They're not making representations of things, really. And this is something quite amazing and quite different. And you would think, it will be a very fruitful place thing for people to be looking at in terms of brain organization and behavior, in terms of evolutionary studies and so on. Mm-hmm. Especially in terms, I think, of evolutionary studies, because since it's going to be very hard for somebody to say that somebody who paints well has a better chance of passing along his or her genes, and maybe it will take us out of the sort of dead-end discussions that we have on evolutionary theory that just focus on reproductive potential and not on nurturing or comprehension or those kinds of things, which are obviously as important to the human species.
Yeah. Well, when I think about, if we go back generations, we think about some of the great artists or people who were interested in art. Their interest also included, science, mathematics, the environment. John Ruskin comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Da Vinci, Da Vinci, if I'm recalling correctly from my grade school, book on artists, was an inventor as well as an artist.
Oh, and a scientist.
And a scientist,
yeah,
yes.
A person who pursued everything. I sort of suspect that many of the finer artists that we know from today have that same quality of mind. But I think probably since they're squeezed through American media, they get reduced to something less. I was just reading Mark Rothko's a new book. I mean, he died years ago, but his heirs just published it, and it's a sort of difficult book to tie with. But you can see that he's been trying to interpret his art and his desire to make art by going back and reading philosophy and reading history and looking at a much broader pattern of things. I think this all speaks to the fact that the impulse that takes us out there to draw is also this very much the same kind of impulse that puts scientists out there in the world. It's a way of looking originally at things, of trying to get out of the clutter of thought, the clutter that you tend to live in from day to day, and find some freshness and newness.
For someone listening this afternoon who is now thinking, gee, maybe I should, I have a sketchbook around here somewhere. I have some pencils. Maybe what I should do is pick that up again.
No, say that again. I missed something that you said.
Oh, okay. For someone who's listening this afternoon and who is now thinking, maybe I should try this. I've got a sketchbook around here. I've got some paper. I've got some pencils. I've even got some... Well, there's some pastels down in the kids' room. Mm-hmm. Where would a person, where would you advise them to begin, to start?
I think that there's a tendency, if you go back to this, that you'll find yourself drawing exactly the way that you did at the age of 8 or 9 when you stopped, and that will be immensely frustrating to you. and that you have to find some way of kind of kicking it along, forcing yourself to do something differently. And, you know, one of the best things to do is to go out and draw with a group. Take a class. Betty Edwards' book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, I think has gotten thousands and thousands of people drawing by showing them that they can transcend what they were doing from the age of 8. And I run into a lot of people in drawing groups who started with that book, who were kindled by reading it and doing the exercises in it. And that's a good place to begin, I think. Another thing is just to go out and put yourself in front of something and really look at it and say, draw what you see, don't try not to draw what you know, and work from there. I think it really does help to have some instruction along the way. One of the things that I asked along the way was of other artists, and there are a couple of examples in the book. I asked people, how did they bridge that gap when language was overshaking their visual abilities when they were going into adolescence? How did they keep drawing? And for men, the commonest answer was that they copied comics. And for women, it was much harder because they didn't have the kinds of models. A lot of them drew clothing and things like that. Many of them are older people who grew up in an age where fashion illustration was really illustration, not photography, so that you actually had lines that you could copy from newspaper ads and things like that. An enormous number of men that I talked to kept drawing because they copied what was in Mad magazine. And a number of older generations kept drawing because they copied Superman. So, I mean, those are probably places to start also. It's fair to copy. You know, one of my favorite things to do today is to go into a museum or a museum and carry a sketchbook and sit there and try to draw what some artist has seen ahead of me. And it's a way of having this conversation with somebody who may have been dead for 500 years about what was in front of them. And the more you draw, the more rewarding that is, that becomes.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Peter, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Peter Steinhardt has been my guest in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, The Undressed Art, Why We Draw. It's published by Knopf. It's 1:54 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Call it a turnaround Wednesday as opposed to the typical turnaround Tuesday because of the short week due to the Martin Luther King holiday. But anyway you look at it, prices were higher today on the Chicago Board and Trade. Looks like we saw a short covering bounce. We'll talk more about that at 2:06 Central Time with Paul Cooley of ADM Investment Services. Let's go ahead and look at the settlement prices. March wheat, a high on the day of 302, a low of 296, settling 299, up 2.5. May, a high of 309, a low of 303.5, settling 306.25, up 2. July, a high of 316, a low of 311, settling 312.5, up 1. September, a high of 321.5, a low of 318, settling on the low, up 1. December wheat, a high of 330.5, a low of 327, settling 327.25, up 2.25. March corn, a high of 197.5, a low of 196.5, settling 196.75, up 3/4. May, a high of 205, a low of 203.5, settling 204, up 1/2. July, a high of 211.75, a low of 210.75, settling 211, up 1/2. September, a high of 219, a low of 218, settling on the low, 218 there, up 1/4 on the day. December corn, a high of 228, a low of 227.25, settling 227.25, up 1/4. March, a high of 235.5, a low of 234 and three quarters, settling 234 and three quarters, up a quarter on the day. March Oats, a high of 171 and a quarter, a low of 164 and a half, settling 170 and a half, down 1 and a half. May, a high of 158 and three quarters, a low of 155, settling 157 and a half, unchanged on the day. March Soybeans, a high of 521 and a half, a low of 515 and a quarter, settling 517 and three quarters, up 4 and a quarter. May, a high of 523, a low of 518, settling 518 and three quarters, up 2 and a half. July, a high of 529, a low of 524 and a quarter, settling 524 and a half, up 1 and three quarters. August, a high of 531, a low of 527, settling 527, up 1 and three quarters. September, a high of 533, a low of 528 and a half, settling 528 and a half, up 2. November beans, a high of 542 and a half, a low of 537 and a quarter, settling 538 and a quarter, up 2 and a half. And November, I have that November contract in there twice. We'll go ahead and look at the March contract during the closing market report. March soybean meal, a high on the day of 157, a low of 154 and a half, settling 155, 154.40 for the low, settling 155.50, that's up 180. The May contract, a high on the day of 157.40, a low of 155.40, settling 155.90, up 120. March soybean oil, a high 1970, a low of 1952, settling 1961, up 17. The May contract also up 17 on a day, a high of 1984, a low of 1970, settling 1974. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste Quinn has those.
Thank you, Dave. Mostly lower day today on the Merc. January feeder cattle, 107.05, the high, 106.20, the low, finishing at 106.25, down 95. March, 102.70, the high, $100.85, the low, the settlement, $100.92.5, that down 192.5. April, 101 even, the high, the low, 99.85, the settlement, $100.05, and that was down 120. February, live cattle, 91 even, the high, 89.20, the low, 89.35, the settlement, that down 177.5. April, 89.20, the high, the low, 87.90, the settlement, 87.95, that down 147.5. February lean hog, 76.15 the high, 75.10 the low, 75.77 and a half the settlement, that up 20. April, 78 even the high, 76.77 and a half the low, 77.42 and a half the settlement, that down 22 and a half. May, 77.10 the high, 76.30 the low, 77.10 the settlement, that up 35. June, 79.30 the high, 78.37 and a half the low, the settlement, 79.22 and a half, up 17 and a half. February bellies, 94.40 the high, 92.92 and a half the low.